Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Transcription for this podcast is brought to you by HarperTranscriptions.com. If you have any transcription needs, please head on over to our website. And if you mention this podcast, They Had to Go Out, your first transcription will be for free. Stay salty, my friends.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for following all of our social media accounts. And especially thanks for your support to the National Coast Guard Museum, which sponsors us. We've got a good one for you today after our long holiday break. So we're happy to be back. Happy to bring you a full new year of dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories from Coast Guard veterans. So if you haven't subscribed yet, make sure you do. After you listen to this episode, make sure your review is 5 stars so that other people can find it and get excited about the Coast Guard and what veterans have done for this country. We've got on the phone today retired Master Chief Boatswain Mate John Gagnon, born St. Paul, Minnesota, raised in Idaho. Joined the Coast Guard back in 1986 with recruit company Echo 123. Graduated basic training in Cape May. First unit was the Coast Guard cutter Ironwood, Aton cutter up in Kodiak, Alaska. Went from there to Coast Guard Station Rio Vista. They found out he had some Aton experience and sent him to Ant Rio Vista, where he made or struck BM3. Then transferred to the Coast Guard cutter Midget and did kind of a dual tour between the Midget and the Boutwell out in Alameda. Went from there to Station Tillamook, Oregon as a boatswain mate second class. Then to Station Coos Bay, Oregon as a boatswain mate first class. Picked up his first XPO or Executive Petty Officer assignment, the number 2 spot at Station Tillamook as a chief boatswain mate. Went on from there as most surfmen do to the Great Lakes for that first officer in charge tour. Spent that one at Station Erie, Pennsylvania. Proved himself there, was able to get back to the West Coast at Station Bodega Bay as the officer in charge as a senior chief boatswain mate. And then rounded out his career and finished up at Station Humboldt Bay as the officer in charge. And John, we thank you for coming on the show today. Really glad that you were able to make time for us on this Martin Luther King holiday.
All right. Sounds good, Phil. I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. Hey, so as always, we have one question for all of our guests, John. What's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Oh, boy. I've had a couple. But the one that sticks to my mind was I was a brand new BM1 and a brand new surfman. And I had transferred to Station Coos Bay in 1986. And we got a report of a fishing boat that was coming in across the bar, which wasn't a big deal. You know, fishing boats can come and go as they please. They're not, we don't restrict the bar to them. But this one was coming in, and the tower was really concerned because the seas were quite big. So I was on my way up to the tower to check it out and take a look and see what was going on. And on the way to the tower, we got a call that the vessel had lost a person over the side and was in the surf zone south of the South Jetty.
And John, you're setting the scene for us there, could you describe Coos Bay a little bit for us, what the station was like, and then how the bar is there?
Yeah, Coos Bay is one of the four units on the West Coast that has a 52-footer. It has a fairly large bar with a lot of traffic in it. It's the largest bar between San Francisco and the Columbia River. So it's a good size entrance. It's a good size bar. They get freighters in there that, you know, upwards 600 foot. They'll come in for loading grain and wood chips and things like that.
What's the 52 there?
The 52 is the Intrepid.
The Intrepid. And things. Do you remember when they were built by any chance?
I think that the Victory, which was the first one, I think it was put into commission about 1958.
So these things have been running for 20 plus years by the time you're on the helm, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And
best boats Coast Guard's ever designed.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. do you know the upper limit of those things?
You know, what I understand, when they were first commissioned, their sea caving capacity was, once the boat ceased to make headway, it could no longer go out. But the 52 could operate in seas up to 30 foot easily. It could operate 150 miles offshore, surf up to 25 foot. It was just a beast. It was a tank. And unfortunately, the day of that rescue, I wasn't on that boat.
Yeah, well, fair enough. But you're the first, I think you're one of the first 52 sailors that, at least that we've really delved into that thing with. What's the minimum crew on it? Is it four?
Yeah, it's four.
Cox or surfman, engineer, and then two crewmen?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. All right, so at Coos Bay, you're going up to the tower. Tower's where you guys basically keep an eye on it from shore, right? Keep an eye on the bar and the traffic moving back and forth.
When the conditions warrant, there's always a watchstander up there keeping an eye on everything, yeah.
And on this day, you are the watchstander or the OOD?
No, I was the OOD that day. I was the duty surfman that day. I was a senior duty officer.
Okay, that was back when you filled all assignments at the same time, huh?
For the most part, yeah. I mean, we had an OD that day, and I was the surfman, the duty surfman, and the senior duty officer that day.
I got you.
Yeah. So, but anyways, on the way up to the tower, we got a call that they had lost a person off the side. They had lost their engines, and they were in the surf. And so we're headed back to the station, and I jumped on a 44-footer, and off I went across the bar to try and find this person, and yeah, the seas were probably running 16, 18 foot that day. They were healthy, good
healthy
size seas, but they were well within the capacity of the boat. And you know, we were out searching for the boat had actually grounded on the beach there, and one of the crewmen actually some of the people from Station Coos Bay actually helped get people from the ship or from the boat to the shore. But this one person that was lost, we were out in the surf zone just, you know, trying to find this gentleman and looking and doing everything we could. And my CO at the time, he got that 52, the Intrepid, underway, and he came out and he was looking out there too with us. And you know, throughout the day, the seas had built a little bit, and finally the CO called out that, you know, I think I just took a 20-30 foot break on the 52. So it's the biggest seas I've ever been in my entire life on a boat. So they were huge. And then I was basically running back and forth from this little reef on the shore to the jetty tips, and I was in 6 to 8, maybe 10 foot, 12 foot surf at the most. And then the CEO's like, "Yeah, why don't you come on out to the buoy line and we'll just kind of run the buoy line." And it was huge out there. The buoy line was every bit 16, 18, occasional 20, occasional 22-foot waves. It was big. And you know, I felt comfortable. I felt confident out there, but in all reality, that's the first time I had ever been in the surf by myself as a qualified surfman. And after a few hours in the surf, I looked over at the other coxswain that was on the boat with me, and I told him, I'm like, "Hey, this is my first time in the surf." And just the look on his face was like, "Whoa." But, you know, I think I've already proven myself just fine out there operating in the surf and the swell conditions.
At least you held on to it for a couple hours before you, before you let that go, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But one other thing that was kind of interesting was my wife had found out that the case was going on, and she decided to meander out to the tower, and you know, she just sat there watching us in the surf that whole time, and she was pregnant with our first daughter, and it was kind of almost traumatizing for her just to watch the boat just disappear in the swells and then come back up and over the crest of the next one. So And unfortunately, on that case, you know, the gentleman was never lost or was never found that was lost over the side. So, you know, it wasn't a heroic rescue or anything like that. But unfortunately, it was my biggest and hairiest case that I'd ever been on. And it just happened to be my first one as a surfman.
I would ask you a couple questions, John. So, you know, you were up at the tower, you were monitoring the wave action and the case, heard that somebody fell off the boat, knew you had to launch. Mm-hmm. It's your first surf case. What, you know, as you're headed back to the dock, kind of talk us through that. How did you get there? You briefed the crew. Was there anything different because you knew it was the surf?
No. I mean, the crew was well-versed in surf operations. And, in fact, that coxswain that I had talked to, he had just reported aboard about the same time as I had from another surf station in Oregon. So, you know, the surf was well-versed in operations. The other coxswain, you know, I mean, for a while, I had to go down and use a restroom or something on the boat. I don't even remember what it was. But I had to go down for something, and I'm like, here, you just take the helm for now, because, you know, I figured he had the knowledge and skill, which he did. He was a great, great boat driver. And, you know, just going down there, we briefed the crew on what was going on. We gave them every bit of information that we had. And I'll be honest, you know, nowadays the Coast Guard uses GAR scores and they try to mitigate all the risk and stuff. And back then it was the mentality that if you got somebody in there that needs help, you go.
Right.
You know, it didn't really matter. And that was, you know, before we lost crewmen at Clue River and all that stuff, where, you know, now they kind of mitigate the response and they try and do everything they can to keep the coastie safe. And back then, it just wasn't really the mentality. It's somebody's in trouble, you got to go.
I like it.
So,
what's the height of eye on a 44?
The height of eye, basically, if you're sitting on the seat, if you're looking at eye level, you're looking at about a 12-foot wave.
Oh man, so with 30-foot wave action, I mean, we're talking, this thing's towering.
You were looking way up. Oh yeah.
Yeah, you go in the trough, it's towering above you. That's good.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. But luckily it was a nice long period that day, so I had plenty of time between waves to negotiate the next one.
We'll talk to you. I'm sure we're going to have some people that are interested. So running search patterns in a surf zone. You know, we talk all the time. People see the photos of the lifeboats, you know, smashing through the waves, right? I mean, the whole thing is kind of, it's really about wave avoidance until you have to take it, right?
Correct, yes.
So running a search pattern where you got kind of, you know, identified legs, or at least, even if you're running a shoreline search, I mean, you're running a leg, right? And then you probably return back. How do you negotiate a search pattern in 30-foot surf? Even, I mean, you were in 12
really
foot,
don't.
Closer
in,
to the, right?
In any kind of surf, there's really no kind of a search pattern that, you know, the OSs from the sector aren't going to come through with a search pattern and be like, oh, this is what you need to run while you're in the surf zone, because it's not going to be effective.
They might try it, but yeah.
They might try.
Yeah.
They might try. And I'm sure that all the data is great, you know, if it was nice, calm weather and conditions. But, you know, you're out there in waves like that, it's not fun. It's more about survival of you and your crew.
Right.
So, you know, you're not going to, you know, run a Victor Sierra pattern or anything like that out there. You just can't do that. It's not possible. So you do what you can and what you think is going to be most effective out there. And if that's just running, you know, back and forth, like from that little point I was running out to the jetty and just back and forth, because I figured that's where the guy might end up, you know, you do the best you can out there.
Right.
And then you hope you have another asset to back you up, something like a helicopter, which we had that day, that would come overhead and they could run search patterns. So that's more effective. Search and rescue is always an overarching thing. There's always more than one asset if need be out there. You know, if the 44 is not adequate, they're going to send the 52 like they did. And if that's not adequate, they're going to send a helicopter. So it's kind of an overarching thing of search and rescue.
I like how the CO kind of developed you while you were out there and brought you out to the buoy line where the big stuff was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming that was intentional, right? He was like, hey, we've got the weather. I'm gonna let him see it.
I don't know if that was it or if he just thought it was safer out there, but I don't think he realized I was just taking 6 to 8 occasional 10 foot
right
where I was. I was in nice little stuff and I was comfortable. But
well, John,
I learned a lot from, you know, that CO and from a lot of different CEOs. Everybody I've ever been stationed with, I think I take a little bit of them with me, and that's, you know, kind of what made me the person I was.
Well, I'd ask you, what was your most impactful lesson from that OIC?
Yeah, from that OIC, I think it was just kind of a reaffirmation to always put the crew first, and, you know, always look at your crew and what they need, and to keep them safe. Just the part of keeping them safe. So, you know, I learned that from every single OIC and CO I ever had. But, you know, that particular CO I learned quite a bit from. And I really enjoyed being stationed with that person.
Excellent.
Yeah.
You did a ton of other surf stations as a look at your career here. Do you have another surf case that you went on?
Oh, yeah. One of the other cases I had that wasn't even surf, but it was just really, really, really big, was we had a sailboat here in Humboldt Bay. It was, I think they were 40 miles offshore, and they were out in probably 20, 22-foot swells, and the whole crew was sick, and the helicopter came in, and they evacuated everybody off the boat. So then they've got this boat drifting, and it's full of fuel and stuff, and the track line was taking it right to the jetties at Humboldt Bay. And the captain calls me up, and he's like, "Master Chief, I need you to get a boat out there. I need you to get somebody on it, and I need you to take that boat in tow. I don't care what it takes. Just do it." And so, you know, we went out, and at that time, I wasn't driving the boat, but I had a very skilled operator that was with me. You know, I went out with him, and I let the younger guys drive more. As I got further in my career, they became the experts in the boat driving, and I became less of such. But I could still handle my own out there. But we went out there. We were able to get in 22-foot seas. We were able to get another crewman onto the sailboat where we could attach a tow and bring it back in.
How did you get him on, or her?
Basically, the coxswain and the surfman just managed to get the boat close, and we decided to go right off of the stern. So basically, we backed up, got over there, and he just got close enough, the waves allowed it, and he just kind of rolled over onto the sailboat.
Was that a 47 or a 44?
It was a 47 at the
47,
time.
47, yeah. So yeah. He was, I'm guessing he was on that aft buoyancy chamber, and then you said just rolled off, huh?
Well, we don't put him on the aft buoyancy chamber. That'd be a little bit dangerous. He just kind of rolled over to the rail and onto the boat.
I got you. Okay, all right. Gotcha.
Yeah. So that was a good hairy case for us. And then, you know, we managed to bring the boat in tow, and it was nice and safe, and put the boat to the dock, and we were able to reunite the owners with their boat. So
excellent. Was the bar breaking when you brought her over?
Generally, there was some breaks on the bar. But for the most part, bringing a boat in across a breaking bar is kind of a tricky prospect to do. If we can wait until the weather conditions are better, we'll do that. And if we can wait till daylight conditions, that's even better. But, you know, bringing boats in across the bar, every once in a while, you still experience a break or two that you may not be able to avoid. But we try to get the best conditions. We try to get high water, and that's the best time to try and bring a boat across the bar that's really bumpy and rough.
Yeah, and I think on our first episode, I told one of my most impactful cases, and it was a surf tow. And I'm just curious, you know, like, the way we did it was the bit wasn't made, right? There was just a working turn on it. You hold on to that working turn, and then basically when the brake hits or when it goes down the backside, just kind of let the slack pay out, right? Like it just goes, you just let it pay out. Yeah, is that same thing for you guys?
No, our bits made hard and fast. Were you at Depot Bay by chance?
Golden Gate.
Okay. Yeah, Depot Bay is famous for that. They don't make their bit when they bring them in. They just work a live bit.
Right.
Or, you know, Golden Gate, yeah, same thing. I mean, you've got lots of room to work, but I can understand that. But, no, I've always generally had the bit made.
Okay.
When I've brought them in.
And then I'm just curious, like, what do you do with the throttles? There's just some surfman in training out there right now just listening, critiquing to us, I'm sure, or critiquing this. But you know, when you leave the bit made, how does it go?
And you know, that's basically the beauty of knowing how to operate the boat correctly. You know as the wave comes in, you know it's going to pick up the boat, and that boat's going to start surfing, so you need to apply more throttle, and try and keep the tow line taut as best you can. And then when they get on top of the wave, you bring your throttle back, and it's a little talent that you develop over the years. I think a boat driver, not necessarily surfman, do that, but it's just as you come up, you know, as you've got a lookout that's looking at it, and he's saying, you know, you've got a wave coming in, he's on the face, he's on the top, and now he's going down back. And, you know, you just repeat that over and over and over and over and over again as you're coming in.
Yep, a little finesse to it. I remember, I mean, the first time that you see the boat start surfing by you and you realize, like, oh, I got to bring this thing up to 1950, right? And,
exactly.
Kind of chase in front of it. Yeah, very good.
Exactly. And then when you're bringing a boat in across the bar that's really bumpy and rough, you've always got another boat out there.
Sure.
So, you know, that other boat can absorb the impact behind the towing, the boat being towed, the fishing boat or whatever it might be.
So Bill would kill me if I didn't ask, but how did you go from Aton to surf units? Like, what was the, was that just an assignment thing that just kind of happened, or was that something that you wanted to do?
It was just kind of an assignment thing that for the most part happened. I came off of that 378 and I was just looking at available billets, and my wife and I thought, you know what, let's try and get a shore base station. And, you know, I'm from North Idaho. So I thought, let's try the Pacific Northwest. And my, my bosun on the 378, ironically, was he was a surfman. So he kind of talked up surf stations and things like that. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to put in for these surf stations. And then ironically, he reported the exact same surf station that I did, and we reported like the exact same day.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, very good.
So it worked out real well for me.
Perfect. Well, yeah. Let's talk about first.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
First OIC tour. I mean, you know, the Coast Guard's unique, right, in that it allows enlisted personnel to serve as officers in charge.
What, yes, it is. I think it's the only one.
Yeah, well, let's talk about when did you take your board? Do you remember what year around about?
It was 2000.
So that was before my time. When mm-hmm. you took the board, how was the process?
It was, you know, nerve-wracking, as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you study up for the board, you study, and then you never know what's going to be on the board. And it's just a lot of studying. I would wake up at like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I would go into work, and I would just, you know, I had until like, you know, 7 o'clock. So I had 3 hours of just quiet time with all the books and everything. Cause, you know, that's before we had internet, computers, all that stuff. So you were actually going through manuals, reading the manuals, and just trying to get all that stuff down.
And did you have to do I guess it would have been a group and a district board then?
Yeah, I did go to I went to a group board first. And, you know, I remember coming out of that board and, you know, one of the things they had me do is they said, I want you to go back and talk to your CO, and I want you to go back and talk to your chief and find out their most harrowing days in the Coast Guard, how they handled it. And so I went through all of that process and went back and talked to them and got some sound advice. And then I appeared before the PAC area board.
Well, so now, I mean, that opens the next question, John. What did they, you know, what was one of those most harrowing cases that they brought up to a young officer in charge wannabe?
Boy, you know, that was 20 years ago. I don't remember exactly what they told me.
Hey, worth a shot.
I know when it comes down to it, you got to watch out for your people. And so that's always got to be the number one thing.
Good. So
you know, I would always say that I would put my people's needs ahead of my own, but not ahead of my family's. That was kind of one of my mottos in the Coast Guard.
Good. I think it's a good mantra to live by. So when you report as the OIC of Station Erie, let's talk about a Great Lakes station compared to a Pacific Northwest station. How did that go?
It went fine. It went really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I reported aboard, and I relieved a fine officer in charge who had done a great job. And, you know, I had a little bit different way of doing things, but you know, the crew seemed to acclimate really well, and I had a great XPO who had held, you know, he had reported aboard about the same time I did, and he had already done a tour at Station Erie, so I already had that wealth of knowledge that he had brought. So that was it was really good for me.
Were they in? Was that an ice rescue unit then?
It was an ice rescue unit. Yeah, we did a lot of we didn't do a lot of ice rescues, but we seemed to practice for a lot of ice rescues.
Sure. What kind of equipment did you have back in 2000 to do ice rescues?
Oh boy, all we had was the dry suits and such, and they had just come out with a new sled that would operate on the ice, and ice commander dry suits, and I can't remember all the different equipment that we had, but we, you know, we didn't have the cool airboats or anything like that. It was just a sled that you would tow behind you and push out to the people and try and pull them out of the water.
Like a Was it like an aluminum John boat or something else?
No, well, no, we did actually have an aluminum John boat for that. But then they started doing things with like a hard plastic kind of sled thing, if I recall correctly.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember the term for it, but.
You missed out on the airboat.
No, I, yeah.
So you made Chief while you were at Station Coos Bay, right?
Yes, I did.
Yep. Yeah. And then were you initiated?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. How was that?
It was interesting.
Interesting.
I mean, yeah. You know, now the initiations nowadays are more politically correct as they should be, but you know, back then I still remember freezing my butt off, and I remember, you know, laying in a big box full of ice. they had the electric, all that stuff that, you know, they don't have anymore. You know, that's now considered hazing, but yeah, it was an experience. It was a good experience.
Good. 1 second, John. Hold on 1 second. I'm back. Sorry about that.
No problem at all.
Yeah, so it's so a little more hazing back then than maybe now, huh?
Yeah, there was, but it was, you know, it was something that you knew that was going to happen. It was, you know, it was voluntary at the time.
It's good.
And I think it still is, but yeah.
Yeah, still voluntary. But I mean, if you don't do it, you're just shamed into doing it, I think, is the kind of the way it works. But you got to join the fraternity, I guess, or the brotherhood, sisterhood, sure.
Of course you do, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so did you ever do any law enforcement?
Not a great deal. I mean, just, you know, the mom and pop boardings, things like that. I never did anything, you know, really related to drugs and, you know, like they do down in Florida. No, I never did anything like that.
Well, I know sometimes I think some of the best law enforcement stories come from those commercial fishing vessels up in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have any great stories about that, but I definitely inspected quite a few of them and boarded quite a few of them. Yeah.
Sure. Did you, when you were the officer in charge or at that command cadre level, was there a lot of outreach to local communities?
We did a lot of outreach. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both, you know, Erie, my predecessor was huge into, you know, law enforcement community and, you know, I was part of the Erie Boating Safety Task Force and part of the narcotics interdiction team that the sheriffs had put together. And so, yeah, I did a lot of that kind of things in Erie and worked with agencies. And then, you know, I got to Bodega Bay and there, I worked with the agencies there were, but they're, you know, they were kind of few and far between out there because Bodega was a really small town. And then, you know, here in Humboldt, I worked with the sheriff's department quite a bit. And, you know, I worked with local agencies here that were kind of functioning out of Humboldt Bay.
Right.
And kind of ironically, the Humboldt Bay Sheriff actually had the exact 44-footer that I qualified surfman on as their sheriff's boat, so that was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. You can teach them all to drive it, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. But every time they get me on it, they want me to baby it. So it's like, okay, well, whatever.
Well, I mean, it's got to get a little age on it by the time they got it. They got to be careful with it.
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah.
Well, let's take it way back to Station Rio Vista. I'm assuming you probably got your first coxswain letter either there or at the Aton unit, right?
You know what? I did not. I did not get my letters there. I was only there total between the two units. I was only there 18 months, and just a little bit of that was a BM3.
Yep.
So, you know, I didn't get a qual letter there.
So Tillamook?
Tillamook was my first actual standard boat qualification letter, yeah.
What was the first case?
First case I had was a boat that had lost its engine inside Humboldt Bay.
Okay.
So just went over there and pulled them off the beach and towed them back to the marina. That was my very, very first case as a coxswain.
And you refloated them?
We did, yeah. Yeah.
How big was the boat?
It was just a little tiny, like 17-foot fishing boat.
Okay, so it didn't require a lot of power to like get
no,
it back out?
Not no. at all. Yeah. Not at all. No, that was my first case as a coxswain.
Yeah.
I still remember it to this day.
It's funny. I remember towing a 47 off a beach in San Francisco, and I've never applied that much power to anything before. But, pretty entertaining. You never know when you try to refloat boats what's going to happen.
You never know. That's correct. Yeah. Which I know that's kind of a rarity nowadays that they do that.
Right. And was that was your first case as a coxswain, I'm guessing, right?
Yes, correct.
What was your first as a crewman?
I think it was a tow. I'm pretty certain it was a tow with a 44, and it was down off of, it was in the southern part of our AOR. And it was just kind of a routine tow, went out and towed it in. I still remember to this day who the coxswain of the boat was, and and learned a lot from that person as well.
What did he go on to do?
He retired as a Master Chief. And right. I think he still works for the Coast Guard as a comm room watch standard.
Nice. Good.
Yeah.
What about your time on the cutters?
Time on the cutters was great. I enjoyed every minute of it. And, you know, I tried to get back to a cutter after Erie. And, you know, with that Surfman qual and the OIC qual, there's no way in heck that was going to happen. But, you know, my brother-in-law, who's a he's a retired gunner's mate chief, and he makes fun of me because I'm 6 months short of my Surfman or my coxswain pin.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Where did you guys sail on the 378s? Did you go in any crazy
Alaska.
Ports? Alaska.
We did a lot of Alaska patrols, but we did have the opportunity to sail to Japan one time for one of their festivals.
Okay.
So we tied up for like 10 days right in downtown Tokyo. And then we went and did an all pet.
Were you guys deck or ops?
Deck.
Deck. Okay. Well, that's good. I mean, at least they put you in the right section.
Yeah, they did.
What did you ever have a case out at sea on one of those?
Oh yeah, we had several cases. We had quite a few. I remember one of the cases we had was a fishing boat that was on fire. They had gotten the fire out by the time we got there, but we boarded the fishing boat with, you know, the old OBAs and you know, went down and did all of our, you know, cleaning up everything and got everything out of there. And I remember one of the things that I key was from that case was, you know, you do what you train. And so I was trying to light off the OBA canister, and I could not get the dang thing to light off. And I realized it's because I hadn't taken the top off of the OBA canister, because you never do that in training.
Yeah, that'll kind of kill it. That's probably one of those things that you need to figure out.
Yeah, I couldn't quite get that bail up in the excitement of everything. And that's because I hadn't taken the top off.
That's good. I think it's pretty cool that they even transferred you guys with all the gear to go down.
Yeah, we went down. We started doing the cleanup and the atmospheric testing and everything for them. And so, yeah. And we had a few cases. We had a fisherman that we had medevaced and got him on our boat, and unfortunately we lost him on the way back to port. So.
Yeah, and you guys were going to service medevac him all the way back in? Like, you guys were – he was, what, embarked him on the cutter and started bringing him back?
Yeah, started bringing him back. He was – I don't remember what his injury was, but, yeah, he – you know, he was in sick bay, and I know that he didn't quite make it back to port. He passed away on the cutter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy how, you know, being that far out to sea, I mean, you're basically it. That's it. It's a 378 or bust, or, you know, whatever cutter's out there.
Yep.
Very cool. What so let's go, John, into the deeper stuff. From your entire Coast Guard career, what's one or two of the most impactful lessons? What are you always going to carry with you? You already said taking care of your people. I need another one.
Oh, I can't give you more than that.
No, you got to go to a different one. That's a good one, though. I mean, that's one that everybody should take to heart.
You know, basically knowing your craft is crucial in that job. You know, you have to know what you do, and you have to understand how to apply a policy. Sometimes there's a difference between how to apply the policy the right way and how to apply it correctly. And so, you know, it's the difference of being a leader. You know, there's different ways to apply policy, but you have to apply it in a manner that is going to have the best outcome in that. So that's always critical. And just, you know, knowing your craft and knowing how to apply the policies. You know, I used to say when I was in the Coast Guard, when I was more senior, when I was a senior chief and master chief, you know, they weren't paying me to drive a boat. They were paying me basically for the leadership that I brought to the unit.
Right.
So I wasn't being paid for being a bosun mate. I was being paid for being a leader.
And did you ever have any, you know, like, I guess with the group commanders or anyone, were there ever any issues where, you know, a decision was kind of made at the top that didn't quite either take care of your people or fly with policy as you interpreted it?
Yeah, I did. There was, you know, I would butt heads with the group commanders from time to time. And, you know, that was primarily when I started doing the officer in charge stuff, it was a sector commander. But some of the policies they made just didn't jive with how I interpreted a policy. So, you know, I would bring that up to them. You know, one example is one of the units I was at, the sector wouldn't allow us to claim cases if I had launched an asset. And, I mean, the Coast Guard regulation says right in it that, you know, one, I have to launch an asset if I hear of a distress, and two, that it will be claimed as a case. And some people didn't want to do the paperwork, so they'd be like, no, we didn't launch on that. We can't claim that as a case. And I got a really good lieutenant in at the that particular sector who really took good care of me.
Yeah, so what? So I mean, like, you know, to broach that issue where you do have a disagreement on the top. I mean, is that what you did? Just kind of build support from the internal staff up there, and then take the issue up?
I did, but you know, I would have a really good rapport with the senior staff up there. You know, the captain, I would meet with him on a regular basis. I would go up there and we'd just sit down and, if nothing else, just have a cup of coffee and discuss how things were going. So, you always wanted to make sure that you know you had a good graces of the captain, and he understood where you were coming from.
Right.
He or she was coming from. So, you know, when that issue came up, you know, I was fighting kind of a battle. And finally, I laid it out with the lieutenant who I worked for. I'm like, look, this is the policy. It's right here in black and white. There's just no ambiguity in it. It will be claimed as a case. But there was just far too many times that they're just like, no, we didn't launch you on that, so you can't claim it as a case. It's like, yeah, no, yeah, I am.
Yeah, so. No, I you know, it's funny. I totally remember those times too. And you, what always blew my mind was, why would we not want to case it? Because then
exactly.
It kind of goes in your annual stats anyway, right? Like,
exactly.
There's got to be money tied to this somewhere.
That's exactly how it is.
Right.
I mean, they closed a lot of the station smalls on the East Coast, from what I understood, and it's because they didn't have the caseloads.
Right.
Well, by God, I want to claim the caseloads. You know, I want to show the American taxpayer, Congress, that we're actually doing a job here and we're actually launching for valid reasons.
Yeah, and I'm sure the municipality of Erie, Pennsylvania would appreciate that too, right? To be able to,
of course,
yeah, maintain that capability in their port.
You bet. Mm-hmm. You bet. Yeah, yeah.
What kind of boats did you have in Erie?
I had a 47 and I had a 25.
Oh man, 47 in Erie, huh?
Yeah. That's one of the reasons when I was looking for that OIC job I got, I wanted a 47 because, you know, that's what I was comfortable in.
Right.
Were
you at where were you when the 44 transitioned to the 47?
Yeah, I was at Tillamook, and that was one of the first five pre-production places that they put the boats. So in the 47, they designed a prototype boat, which went to Cape Disappointment for testing. And then they designed five pre-production boats that went throughout the country. And Tillamook just happened to be one of those places that got a pre-production boat. So, you know, I was driving 47s before they were even standard.
And what did you think?
I thought it was a great platform. You know, the speed capability was really nice on it. The endurance was nice. We went through months and months of testing on the boat. And, you know, there was a lot of recommendations that are actually on the 47 now based upon, well, some mishaps that I had. So that was kind of cool. But we did also fatigue testing on the boats. And we would go out in the surf for like 8 hours on a 44. And then we would do these little tests where you would push a button and it would measure your response to an item. And then we would do the same thing on a 47. So we did a lot of testing on the boats and their, you know, their capabilities and also the fatigue levels on the boat.
Fatigue testing. Cool. I never even knew that happened. Yeah. That sounds kind of crazy. Yeah. So what would, I mean, was it like a monkey putting a block into a, you know, a square peg into a round hole kind of thing? Is that what they were trying to
call it? We used to call it a monkey test. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they had this little computer and it was tied to, there was two lights. One, there was a light and a button on it, and as soon as you would put your finger on the button, and as soon as the light came, you would push the button. It would measure the response time it took you to recognize that light had come on to when you would push the button. And then we would go out and, you know, we'd go run search patterns for like 8 hours, and then we would go out and we would do surf for 8 hours, and every hour they would measure how long it took that response for us. And it was the University of Washington that did it all, and then they would compile the data for the fatigue limits for the boats.
You know, I always thought they were arbitrary numbers that someone just made up. I learned something totally new today. I'm kind of proud of the service and the University of Washington for making that scientifically backed, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of fun.
Who would have thought? What mishaps did you have on the prototype?
Oh, boy. Let's see.
It's a prototype, so it's okay.
Anchor,
like, nobody can talk smack.
It was a pre-production boat, not the prototype.
Right,
it was
okay.
Pre-production. But, like, the anchor line was not attached to the anchor on the boat. That's how they wanted it. So they were both in that forward compartment on the port side, but they were never attached. And I don't understand why they didn't want it. And I got a line. I was a dummy boat. I was being towed, and the tow boat actually turned and came right down my side, like for a man overboard. And the wind blew me right over his tow line, so I had his tow line stuck in my prop.
Nice.
And my crew was not able to get the anchor out because it was Tillamook in December and their hands were all freezing. So we weren't able to deploy an anchor. We're inside the jetties. We're heading for the jetty. And luckily that 44 pulled us off from our skeg. and allowed us a little bit of extra time to get that anchor deployed. So from then on, the anchors were always attached to the line.
So when all else fails, just come ahead, basically, right? Is that
pretty much?
Yeah, that's the lesson. That's good.
Pretty much. And then the aft buoyancy chamber, it used to have a lip on it that would protrude, forward. It would protrude just off of the edge of that. And I don't understand why the lip was there. But one day doing helo ops, I was out in about 6 to 8 foot, and they had lowered down a little strap to us. And as they were pulling it up, that hook caught that little lip and jerked the helo really good, so much so that they had to cut the cable. So they decided, let's take that lip off of that,
yep,
that
good
forward buoyancy chamber.
That, you know, helo ops seems to be like a precursor to a lot of change, right? Like without fail. Yeah, you don't let an aircraft fall out of the sky.
No, that's a bad thing.
Yeah, due to crappy design flaws, right?
That's a bad thing. Actually, the pre-production boat that I used to run was down in San Francisco. You probably saw it down there.
Yeah, it was SFPD, right?
Yeah, that was the 47203.
That's the one I towed off the beach in Aquatic Park. Yep, there you go.
That's the one I ran.
All right, well, a small world, right?
It is, yes.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, John, we totally appreciate your time today. You got any parting shots or anything else you'd like to tell us?
You know what? Just like I said before, man, watch out for the crew. You know, one of the most endearing words of wisdom I got when I went through that CCTI process was from one of my mentors, and his things is, I got three rules for you as a chief. One, take care of your crew. Two, take care of your crew. Three, take care of your crew.
Perfect.
And, you know, I will never forget that.
I like it. I don't think better words can be spoken, because they'll take care of you, right?
They always will. They will take care of you, yeah.
Yep. Well, John, we so much appreciate it. You know, Happy New Year to you and your family, and wish you guys all the success of 2020.
All right. Sounds good, Phil. I wish the same to you.
Yep. Thanks again for sharing your story.
All right, sir. You have a wonderful day. Thank you very much.
Same to you. Thanks.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org, that's CoastGuardFoundation.org, to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.